You are listening to Elevate, the official podcast of Elite Agent for real estate industry sales professionals, property managers, and leaders. Each episode, we bring you the best minds in business and real estate to help you list more, sell more, and elevate your results. To connect with all things Elite Agent, including the latest news, coaching, and features, subscribe at our website, eliteagent.com.
Welcome to another episode of the Elevate Podcast. I'm Samantha McLean, editor of Elite Agent.
And I'm Mark Edwards, the publisher of Elite Agent. We are back again.
Yes, we are definitely back again, and we are rocketing towards the end of the year.
I know, it's crazy, isn't it? So we're well into December now.
It seems like every year goes faster and faster and faster, and I read somewhere that there is an antidote to that.
What's that, Sam?
It is because as we get older, we get so used to doing the same things over and over again that it's like the time and space in our brain is going faster or something like that.
I read this thing where the analogy is when you're driving down the road, that you drive down the same road every single time, yep. And then time disappears on you because you've done it so many times before.
Yeah, we'll put a link in the show notes to the article, but basically, you know, like if you want the years to slow down, start drinking your coffee with the other hand.
I was just going to say do things differently, but I suppose that's the...
Well, it's a hot tip. If you're dominant on the right hand, then...
Try brushing your teeth with your left hand.
God,
that's messy.
Apparently it does slow time down, though, if you're learning to do new things.
So who we got on the podcast this week?
Funnily, we should be talking about psychological type things. So we've got Pancho, our resident Oprah, actually. He's back for the third time, actually. He's our first third offender.
I know.
Podcast studios.
So Pancho has been contributing to Elite Agent magazine for quite a few years now.
Yeah, a couple of years, and he's been in for Transform Coaching and stuff like that, and he's a super interesting guy. He actually has some really interesting stuff, and he has just come back from Harvard University, and he went there, number one, to learn how Harvard teach. Because, you know, Harvard do have this interesting teaching method, which Ray White had brought to Australia a couple of times. But also, you know, he trained some of the top salespeople, not just in selling, but in the art of negotiation.
But also Pancho is not just real estate, is he? He's got a breadth of experience right across a number of different industries that he's able to bring to some of his teachings.
Yes, but he's had a hand in a few very successful real estate agents. Now, I can't reveal who they are because that would be breaking the cone of Vegas. Obviously, but Pancho, really interesting guy. And so this podcast is actually all about the art of negotiation versus the art of selling. And it's a very subtle thing. You know, would you rather be known as a great sales guy or would you rather be known as a great negotiator? And so really, this whole thing is about learning how to negotiate better, how to tap into people's innermost desires. In this podcast too, we talk about the difference between information and influence, because everyone can have information, but it's how you use that information to truly influence the outcome that you want for your vendor, your buyer, etc.
By the sounds of it, there are going to be a ton of good actionable tips out of this one.
Actually, the thing I like about talking to Pancho is he really makes me think. And so this podcast, we went backwards and forwards on a few different subjects just to make sure that I'd gotten my head around what he was saying. This stuff is not simple. This is high level, you know, negotiation tactic. So I took notes, as I always do, pulled out the best stuff, hopefully, and it is all available in the action guide, which you can get at eliteagentelevate.com.
All you need to do is pop your email address in there and it'll come winging back to you in that same email address. Just like magic.
And if you found yourself downloading a few of these free action guides, maybe you want to consider getting them delivered.
So you can either go out and get yourself a very big office printer that's going to print it out in A3 and fold it in half and staple it, or you can support the show and subscribe to Extra and we'll do all the hard work for you. Print it off into a 40-page booklet, stuff it in an envelope, lick a stamp and send it on off to you so it will arrive every month with all of the month's podcasts on there and a few extras.
Yeah, that's why we call it Elite Agent Extra, because 2 months between magazines is sometimes a long time. And Extra will be going on through the holidays, right?
It sure will. And as a subscriber, you can also get access to all of the previous issues as well. So there's a lot of great information in there. And also, if you want to do any of that Christmas time reading, perfect opportunity for you to do so.
That's it, inspiration for your new year. Well, I think that's about it.
I hope everybody enjoys this podcast with Pancho and get a lot out of it.
On with the show. Welcome back to the podcast, Pancho Marotra.
Thank you for having me here.
You're like a third offender.
Third offender? Please explain.
I think this is the third time we've had you on the podcast, which makes you third time lucky.
Okay. I'm looking forward to it.
You've been sending us articles in over the last 6 months or so, but we haven't seen much of you. So what have you been up to?
I'm busy. As you know, I do a lot of training. I do a lot of training with agents. I'm also involved in other industries as well. So I do a lot of work in the IT sector, finance and banking, funds management, retail. So I do a lot of traveling. So I've been fairly busy with that. And plus launching some new initiatives in the business, which is keeping me very, very busy and inaccessible to some people sometimes.
So you've been over at Harvard, haven't mm-hmm. you? You've mm-hmm. traveled all the way over to Boston.
Yeah.
What was that like?
I had two fundamental reasons for going to Harvard, and I found the experience enlightening. It also confirmed a few things to me as well.
That's what it says when you walk through the doors, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Enlightenment's on the inside or something like that.
That's right. That's right. One of my favorite places when I was at Harvard was actually, and most people think I'm a bit of a geek, but was actually spending all my free time in the library. For me, I love knowledge, and I love to spend time reading. And so I locked myself at the library, and they used to come in, get me at closing time. Get out.
That's like what they do with me in the shops.
Okay. Some different addictions, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So today we're going to go over some of the stuff that you learnt at Harvard, but also mm-hmm. some of the articles that you've sent in, because, you know, we've had a lot of inquiries about them, and I know you always get a lot of inquiries about them because mm-hmm. they're real things that people are struggling with.
Yeah.
So let's first of all talk about, there was one a couple of issues ago on the art of celebrating success. Mm-hmm. And I was really interested in this one because sometimes when we're successful, we don't feel like we can celebrate it. Mm. Why is that?
If you ever think about any kind of success that you have in life, it seems to be really fleeting. You know, the moment whereby you're happy, you think about when you buy that fancy thing that you wanted, the enjoyment doesn't last that long. And then you kind of think, okay, well, what else is there? I suppose it comes down to that deeper question, does money buy you happiness? And a lot of people struggle with that. You know, they think that if I keep on making a lot of money, I'm going to be happy. Well, I've been around a lot of people who are extremely wealthy and they're not happy. Mm. So money is not the answer to happiness. I think a lot of people lose sight of the struggle to get there. It's our views of our struggle that make it either enjoyable or it comes through as being, gee, I hated that. But, you know, often I've spoken to people who have struggled, you know, they've put up with a lot of challenges in their life and they achieve something. And then they think about, well, man, that struggle was really worth it.
Yeah.
And I just think that people are very conscious about how other people feel about them.
Sometimes, you know, like I don't know whether this is the Australian way or not, but if I could sort of use Kylie Minogue as an mm-hmm. example, mm-hmm. back in the late 80s,
yes.
she was probably Australia's most profitable music export.
Yeah.
And yet none of us liked her back then. She was mm-hmm. too uncool and, you know, we didn't like her basically because she was successful. I think they call it the tall poppy syndrome.
Yeah.
And I think the same way, there are people that will always celebrate everything that you do. Mm-hmm. Then there are people that, you know, will sort of say congratulations, but really
with a gritted
yeah, with teeth. With a grimace emoji on their face.
Yes.
Like
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
and I think that makes some people, particularly in the real estate industry, like want to downplay their successes. Mm-hmm. Like, is that your feeling as well? Like that people have actually lost that ability to sort of say, okay, I won this great listing or I've got this great sale price and now I'm going to go and celebrate.
I think a lot of it comes down to who you are as an individual. If you've been taught to celebrate your wins and also think about your losses at an early age, it tends to create that behavioral pattern when you're a little bit older. The environment that you're brought up in has a huge impact on who you become.
Mm.
It's not necessary it's graved in stone, but it has a hell of a lot of impact on that. And whether some people can celebrate or not is pretty much, it's so parental and peer-driven.
Yeah, we've gotten deep already. Yes. Deep really quick today.
Yeah, I think you last told me I was the Oprah Winfrey. I said, well, yeah. I'll take that as a compliment. It's happening right across the board, not only in this industry, but across other industries as well.
Yeah.
It seems like we're just so fixated on more and more and more that we can't celebrate what we're actually achieving.
An achievement for me might be a day off. I would celebrate that.
Yeah.
But then, you know, maybe I don't want to let everyone know that that's my life, is celebrating a day off.
It seems like I'm really, you know, concerned about all this social media. You see all the stuff happening with people. You know, they're driving this and they're doing this lifestyle and all this. We want more, we want more, we want more. And there's nothing wrong with having more, but perhaps, you know, a dose of reality. As I say, there's a lot of delusion, and delusion is real.
And social media is to blame?
Well, a lot of the problems that we're seeing is all about this.
Yeah.
You know, the perfect figure, the perfect this, the perfect that. It was actually interesting because I haven't put a video up, and I might. I go regularly to Auckland because my family lives there, and my father's a retired plastic surgeon. And we were just having a really a conversation about people and patients. And he said something really quite interesting. He said, you know, you can change the outer look of a person, you know, in a 2 or 3 hour operation, but the inner is a lot harder to change because those patterns are so well ingrained in their psychology. And he's told me even people who look fantastic coming out of a surgery, you know, 6 months down the train, whatever they've had, their nose, whatever they've done, and it looks beautiful, they still feel ugly in the inside.
Mm. So unless you deal with what's on the inside, it's never going to go away.
Nah. I mean, how many times have you been around people who are very, very attractive? And within 5 minutes, you're going, my God, I wish I just could leave. Mm. And how many people have you found that, let's just say, not as attractive as them, but they have a really, truly engaging personality and you're drawn to them and you want to be around them because they make you feel good about you?
Mm.
I don't think a lot of people will actually sit down and think about this a lot. The outer look has become the most prevalent thing in society. I think we're losing sight of our deeper values that are really important as individuals.
Yeah. So the takeaway for that would be, if you're thinking about your customers or something like that, the takeaway is stop thinking about how you look and how you're coming across and get over there and think about the other person and how they're thinking and how they're feeling and how you can make them feel good
about themselves. And it's about being true as well.
Mm.
You know, it's not like putting it on, because, you know, this has created a lot of problems as well. This put on false bravado. It will catch you out at some stage.
Yeah. Well, we know that social media, like, you know, people don't post their ugly photos on social media. You know,
we try not to.
I've watched some people take 20 photos to get a good one. I'm not saying it's me.
Damn.
You know, would never admit to that. But anyway, let's move on. Like I said, we're talking about negative thinking patterns anyway, which is we move from the art of celebrating success, which I think is super important anyway, into how to avoid negative thinking patterns. And that was your most recent article.
Yeah. Letting it go.
Yep, let it go. I love that because I think of that Frozen song every time I hear let it go.
Yeah. I've actually played it in a training session.
Oh, have you?
Yeah, and it's because I got two younger nieces who love that Frozen.
Yeah.
And I think I've heard it about a million times.
Yeah.
And it's such a cathartic song. Just let it go.
I now want to come to one of your training sessions.
Yeah, well, you never know.
So in this article, you say it doesn't matter how positive a person we generally are, we all get impacted by negative thinking patterns. Yeah. So, you know, like we're always thinking, I could have done better. Like I was speaking to a group of property managers last week and the presentation went well.
Yeah.
I got good feedback. I didn't suck. But the one thing that I kept thinking when I walked out was, oh, I forgot to say this.
Yeah.
So out of a 45-minute presentation where, you know, I'm told basically it was good, all I can think about
was the negative.
Was the negative. Yeah. Why is that?
It's just an automatic response.
Why do we dwell on it, though?
It's natural.
Okay. How do we get past it?
Can we get past it?
Yes. You were supposed to be in here to solve these problems.
Yeah. It does require you to get a little bit more rational about that. And that's a challenge for most people. Life is a series of decisions that you make. So it's a decision that you've actually made to get upset. And the consequences are that you are upset, you look at the negatives, whereas you fail to look at what you actually have achieved. It's just that ability to disengage that emotional mindset at that moment is what separates us. Unfortunately, that actually takes a lot of training. I mean, I do a lot of work around sports psych, and one of the key things that you'll find is that people at the top of any game have an amazing ability to not react in the moment and to make a right decision most of the time. I do a lot of work around tennis. So I started my sales journey a long, long time ago. I left home and I was based over in Harry Hopman's ranch a long, long time ago when he was running the academy in Florida. And I was playing the qualifying circuit to get onto the ATP tour. And one of the key things which I learned was that is that, and you had to learn real quick, otherwise you lost, is that each opponent was different. So what does that mean? Adapting, changing strategy, changing execution, understanding your psychology. And that's where reading people came all about, is until you can start to read yourself, it's very difficult to respond differently. So we were very fortunate that we had people who had been there and were telling us, okay, under stressful situation, this is how you're going to react. And so we started to become aware of that, become aware of our own reactive way of thinking. So that means we became self-aware. And that's important, because until, you know, when people talk about self-awareness and how you get it, well, you actually need to be taught, what's your trigger moment when pressure comes on you? How are you going to react? Because if you've done it once, I'll guarantee you'll do it twice, three times, four times, five times, 100 times. And therefore, it becomes ingrained. And you don't even know you're doing it, and you're doing it.
Well, sometimes, yeah, like over time, I suppose I've kind of learned this because I've talked to enough top performers to start to recognize these patterns in myself,
yeah,
which is good. It's a perk of the job, I suppose.
Yeah, it's good fun.
Sometimes now when I feel that sort of a negative thought entering my head, I kind of, you've got to recognize it, right?
Yes, to be able. Recognition is key.
Yeah. So what would be your advice for people who are sort of being influenced by the
negativity?
Let's call it the negative committee in their heads. Yeah.
Is it really a committee? Yeah. I was actually, I gave one person two extreme ways to doing this to actually get a control of the negative thought in their head. I actually said, every time that negative voice comes into your head, tell it to F off. He said after a week of doing it, the negative voice stopped. And he says, what happened next? I says, I had awareness of my thoughts. I said, I could actually change it. He says, this is the first time in nearly 10 years he was actually able to change it.
Do you replace it with another thought?
Yeah.
It's replace it with something that you...
Yeah, it's actually a strategy that we learned playing tennis. Mm-hmm. It's called reset, refocus, and give yourself a positive thought. That's the reason why tennis players go to the towel. Sports science is really, really sophisticated. Their heart rates are monitored. Their stress levels are monitored. You'll often find most coaches have a heart rate monitor that's coming to their iPhone, giving them how the athlete is performing under pressure on specific points.
Yep.
So what they're now training is that every time you make a mistake, you go to the towel. That 20 seconds of deep breathing to take a deep breath, it takes you about 6 seconds to what I call stop the what they call the amygdala hijack. It's like road rage.
That's that part of your brain that takes over,
Yeah. And so we got taught that, and that was you go to the towel, you take a deep breath, reset, refocus, give yourself a positive thought, and get back into the game. So they can do it within 20 seconds to refocus their mind. And unfortunately, agents who aren't taught that become a hostage to that emotion all the time.
Yeah.
And it becomes a series of repeated behaviors.
So someone hangs up the phone. I'm crap.
Yeah. Okay. So if we're going a little bit more into my background, I came to this country over 20-odd years ago, and I worked at the American Express call center. I was pretty good in selling beforehand, but I really enjoyed telephone sales, and I became the number one rep for selling corporate cards cold over the phone. So in those days, we didn't have Google. We had the yellow pages. Do you remember those yellow pages?
I do. And dialing big, for dollars.
A to M and N to Z.
Yep.
And the big monitors that they sat on top. I got quite good at cold calling, so I left there after a few years, and I set up my own agency doing cold calls. And to me, cold calling is the most fun you can actually have in life. I've actually got an addiction to it.
Wait.
Yeah. Wait. I think it's really – and I set up an agency doing cold calling for Dell and Hewlett Packard. So we had 15 people on the phones calling up IT managers, setting up appointments for them. So I got really, really quite good at cold calling. And I actually sat down about 6 months ago and calculated how many cold calls I've made so far in my life. 226,000.
Oh, my God. That's amazing.
Yeah. And the people in my company want to stop me doing it because, I mean, we've got a lot of other things happening there where I don't have to do it. But I still like to spend at least 45 minutes one day a week cold calling people because I think it's the most fun you can actually have in life. Calling someone you don't know, getting a conversation, getting a meeting, and potentially doing a deal. I mean, wow, how much higher can you get? It's just my views on it are different though.
That's one thing is that you actually approach it with the mindset of I'm going to have fun.
Yeah, totally.
Whereas, you know, for me, I would go.
I don't even think about the result.
You're just going to go in there. You're going to have fun. You're going to talk to someone new. You're going to build a relationship.
Yeah. I have a particular mental process that I teach all the guys that I train to get them into that zone. And then they actually learn how to remove the anxiety around the call and they just focus on actually doing the calls. And then they get amazing results. It's just a mental technique that I learned when we were playing tennis that works in this area as well.
Yeah. So it sounds to me like it's a muscle memory thing as well. Mm-hmm. Like obviously you did it 226,000 times. Mm-hmm. You know, number one, what I'm about to do is fun.
Yeah.
Or alternatively, if you do have a bad experience on the other hand, it's that, okay, breathe, reset, refocus.
I don't even think about it anymore.
Yeah.
For me, I don't actually have to breathe or reset anymore. I just get on to the next one.
So it's like breathing.
Yeah. One of the key things is that fear is actually felt in the body first.
But I heard that that is actually the same sense or the same sensation rather as excitement.
Yeah.
It's just that we label it differently.
Yeah. It's a different response. So it was actually interesting. About 3 months ago, I was in the Hunter Valley and I was doing a speaking conference for an IT company and I thought I'd go for a run down the road.
Yeah.
And I was gently running down. I was going, and then within 2 feet, I just spotted a brown snake.
Yep.
And it was around about 4 meters long. And it's I had better snake. Brakes than a Formula One car. And then okay. I just saw it. I didn't think twice. I just stopped and I ran the other way. I think I must have ran for about 20 meters and I go, it was just a holy crap moment.
I'm picturing Roadrunner.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I know it would have been a good video moment. But here is the aspects of fear. There are two aspects of fear. Real fear, which is always external, and internal fear, which is based on a feeling. Most people don't understand, but as humans, we're actually hardwired to spot danger, especially snakes, because they killed us. We actually can spot a snake better than an animal can.
Good to know.
Yeah. But the internal fear, the feeling that comes in is a self-creation.
Mm.
And we go, oh, my God, I'm being rejected. Oh, my God, I've lost the deal. Oh, my God, they've got 3 other agents in. I was having a conversation with one particular agent, and he was going, you know, the moment the client says, I've got 2 other agents in and I'm just going on the attack. So we've got 3 forms of defense, attack, freeze, or run. He chose to attack. He was going at the client. He said, well, you know, just took one conversation and he thought differently about it. And his role, so he said, it's actually quite fun now. I actually want them to have other agents in because I know I'm so much better.
Well, you can definitely ask better questions that will make them.
The engagement.
Yeah.
As I said, the battle is never out there.
The battle's always.
In here.
Yeah.
And in here. And how well you do it will depend upon the success and the happiness that you actually have in life. To be able to be very rational in the approach to adversity is the key. I've often said mistakes are repeated because you haven't learned from them.
Mm. Do you know what? My mother used to say that too.
Yeah,
she used to say that the universe will send you the same thing over and over and over again until you've learned what you were meant to.
Yeah.
I just thought she was being annoying.
Well, I would probably say it's.
I think she's right.
It's a lot to do with causality, cause and effect, equal dynamics.
Yeah,
you do one thing and you'll get a response. Most people just do one thing, but they have so low awareness of the response. is because they're in their heads all the time and they can't seem to expand their awareness to be outside of their head to see what the reality is they're like.
So it's almost like you've got to get up in the helicopter above yourself and have a look at, well, why am I feeling the way I'm feeling?
Yeah. Edward de Bono has some great books on that. We've actually incorporated some of his methodologies. Is the six hat principle, is actually having a different hat on a different way. And I think I wrote in this article, the situation you're facing, how would that be viewed from, say, a doctor, a firefighter, a teacher, a grandparent? Each person would view that event differently. And so it makes you think that, you know, you need to step out of the picture and go, well, what am I actually dealing with? And it's difficult for many people to do that because they're so invested in the outcome.
Because sometimes in your head, the problem feels like it's this big, very big.
Yeah.
I'm waving my hands around.
Yeah. And someone comes in from the outside and goes, what the hell are you doing that for?
Yeah, I was going to say, really, really, it's just a slightly unpleasant moment in time.
Yeah.
It's the way that you deal with it.
When you have a problem event, either you're seeking control of the event or it's an attack you feel on who you are. So you've got to be able to separate the two because the strategy for dealing with those two ways of thinking are totally different.
So the snake's real and the stuff going on in my head needs to be dealt with.
Yeah. The snake is the easy one to deal with.
Yeah. Well, I don't know about that. Some people might disagree with you, but...
Well, here's the thing.
Yeah.
With the snake, you just respond, right?
Yeah.
No thought.
Leave.
Leave.
Yeah.
You've got an exit point. But with the external danger, you don't actually think about it too much afterwards.
Yeah.
And you kind of laugh about it. The external is the reality. The internal is the creation. And this becomes difficult for many people because they just keep on doing the same thing over and over again.
Creating their own problems.
Yeah. It's a major issue for many, many people because it's an endless loop and it's going round and round in circles. And then 5 years down the track, they're spinning their wheels the same way. 10 years down the track, spinning the same wheels the same way. And it's a waste of life.
Well, that's it. That's why some people now have their date of death tattooed to their arms so that they can constantly remind themselves.
Yeah, time matters.
That life is short. Yeah.
And, you know, I often talk about that money you can always make, but time you can't get back. There's a great book, Don't Sweat the Small Stuff. It really doesn't pay.
Well, me too. I watched The Masked Singer this year and that's time of my life I'll never get back.
I've got to admit, I have never watched it. I'm going, why were you there in the first place?
It's okay. Yeah. It's all right. You didn't miss anything.
No, I didn't miss anything? Oh, no. Well, I didn't know who won.
No, it was a robot, I think. But,
wow. Okay.
Yeah. So let's talk about negotiation now. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about your time at Harvard because I'm really excited to hear about that. Tell me about why first you went to Harvard to study negotiation and negotiation techniques.
The primary reason I went to Harvard was to see how the top lecturers teach.
Yeah.
I wanted to compare myself to them. I wanted to see what the world's best were.
They're good.
They're very good.
A couple came out here and I did a course with them and I would say it's probably the best.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to compare myself to the best, learn as well.
Yeah.
And it was actually interesting. There was a dean from another university who offered me a position to train at his university during the negotiation course. Because what I did is I challenged the negotiating professors on certain concepts that I didn't agree with. One thing I will do is if I don't agree with something, I will let you know it. And funny thing is they started to use my terminology on the third day off the course. I said, this is really good. So that's the primary reason I went there. I wanted to see how my teaching style compared to their teaching style. I was pleased that I was at that level. I just wanted a confirmation.
I think it's really interesting, you know, like with some of the obviously really well-educated people that we have the pleasure of talking to, such as yourself. The one common thing is that you guys never stop learning. Like I have never met a top performer or a top trainer or a top coach of any kind who isn't always
learning,
still continuing to learn.
Yeah. Well, it's actually interesting. My father's really quite funny. He's 89 years old and he still gets all the latest magazines around the world on plastic surgery. And I said, well, you haven't been cutting for about 15 years or longer. Why do you do it? He says, I'm always learning. the top people continue to learn because they're wanting to evolve, and learning becomes a passion of theirs.
Yeah.
Knowledge applied is absolute power.
That's the definition of wisdom. Wisdom equals knowledge applied.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Someone came to my house and he said, oh, my God, how many books have you got? I did a count, 5,500 and about 4,000 digital books.
Wow. That's a lot.
That's a lot.
So it doesn't matter how smart you are, you never know it all. No.
There's such a lot of wisdom out there, and all you have to do is take the effort to be open to it. Mm. And that's the biggest challenge for most people, is they're very resistant. It's once again patterns. Let me do the same thing over and over again. Let me not challenge that process. And in this market, people are really, really married to the process, and they find it very difficult to evolve that process. But the funny thing is, if you look at all the top people in any kind of industry, they're just continually changing that process, but people don't understand that. But the change is very, very minute, but it adds up. I mean, at the IT conference I spoke at a few months ago, my God, talk about disruption. They just look at every industry and they go, how can I disrupt it?
They make it a pastime.
It is a pastime for them.
Yeah.
Industries die, industries are born within days. And so I think it's a big mistake that people do not apply new things to what they're doing all the time.
It's interesting too what you say is that someone else, I think it was Gian Pereira, who was a podcast guest a couple of weeks ago, he has this analogy of a sandhill to do with disruption. So, mm-hmm. you know, you can constantly be moving grains of sand from one place to another, and it doesn't look like you're actually building anything because mm-hmm. they're just small grains of sand.
Yep.
And then one day it looks like a sandcastle, and then the next day it looks like a hill, and then the next day it's the Sahara Desert, like, you know, it's a sand dune. And then the people that look around and see a sand dune, well, it's too late.
Once again, it's our need for instant gratification. Give me the magic line that will close every deal. Give me the magic word.
There are some of those around, apparently.
Well, yeah, I do teach those magic words, but you do need to have a context of how to apply it.
Yep. Yep.
Okay.
So let's talk about this course. Mm-hmm. What was the course about, the negotiation course?
Let me talk about the people that were on the course first. Primarily, we had mergers and acquisition lawyers,
mm-hmm.
fund managers, venture capitalists, oil dealers.
Exciting people then.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, actually, I love those kind of people.
Yep.
Because the discussions are very, very cerebral, and you can really get into the detail, which I love going into.
Yeah.
And most of these guys were involved in buying and selling businesses, quite ruthless in the way they thought about certain things about people in general. They're all about the deal.
Mm.
If you talk about just the way they could frame a discussion was actually brilliant. Their ability to actually look at a number and make it mean something else, financial modeling, really key. We did a lot of case studies, and you actually had to be really, really good at formula writing. So you'd get a case study, but you spent 2 or 3 hours in your room running financial modeling and going, what if scenario here? What if scenario here? What if scenario here? And so you had to be able to present quite strategically. But also some of the interactions got quite personal. It was very deliberate though, the attack on you.
From what I remember, when Ray White brought Professor Groysberg out, they gave us homework to do the night before.
Yeah.
It was like a couple of case studies, one on service and another one on leadership, which employee would you keep kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, spent a day kind of smashing both out, making you automatically try and believe something that you didn't believe when mm-hmm. you walked in the door. If anyone's listening that was there that day, a lot of minds were changed.
Yeah.
A lot of people walked in there thinking both case studies were like very cut and dried.
Yeah.
I still do.
You know, when people talk about preparation, it's a level of preparation that you actually do. As the deals become bigger and bigger, the level of preparation that you do is quite onerous.
Yeah. Not just on yourself, but it's on the actual.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's on the deal, the psychology of the opposing party. I'd spend a lot of time working with fund managers and who are looking to buy assets. And we've got the other opposing people coming in. There's a lot of preparation done.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there's a significant amount of money being exchanged, and you really got to be able to get your outcome.
So the difference between the people that you're studying at Harvard with, mm-hmm. you know, in terms of negotiation, like we're looking at fund managers and CEOs and mm-hmm. pretty serious people, not saying that we're not serious, mm-hmm. as you and I are very serious. But we are both salespeople at heart.
Yeah.
So what's the difference between someone who is a salesperson and someone who is a true negotiator?
It's a really, really good question. And I would say that salespeople and negotiators have very, very similar traits. What we tend to find is that the salespeople tend to focus a lot on pitching, features, advantages, benefits. They tend to do a lot of that. And a good negotiator will do that, but a little bit more. What I found really, really insightful was the amount that a negotiator spends on developing really, really clever questioning techniques, things that just throw you, and how intent they are for listening to you. They really listen. They have a really interesting ability to see things from multiple perspectives. They don't believe their own assumptions. In one way, they're actually challenging their own assumptions at the same time. I spent time working with a couple of mergers and acquisition lawyers. The breadth of their thinking was really quite enjoyable for me to watch them and how they were negotiating a deal and changing your perspectives. One of the key things is changing your perspective is good, but controlling your perspective is even better. How can you do that in a way that you actually understand what I'm talking about, and that you see it as a benefit for yourself? Real art form, but a lot of science behind it as well.
Yeah, that's quite complex, what you've just said there. Yeah. So let me try and break it down. Okay. Let's test my listening skills.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I'm negotiating with a buyer of a property, and they think it's not worth as much as I think it's worth, and they say, well, I'm going to offer you this, and that's it. And then my next port of call is to get a little bit defensive.
Yeah.
Like, hang on a second. It's worth more than that. Yeah. You're dreaming.
Yeah. That's right. What the hell are you talking about?
Yeah. But really, what I should be doing probably
is getting curious.
Is taking a step back and going, why would you say that?
Yeah. Getting curious.
Because then it's not about me and it's putting it back on them. I mean, I've learnt this in practice is the person asking the questions.
Controls.
Is the person who's in control. That's why I've got this microphone.
That's control.
It's a control microphone.
It's okay. You're a control freak.
Yeah. No, not at all. But only some days.
Yeah,
So what we're really saying here is that your ability to question is, and correct me if I'm wrong, equivalent to your ability to be a good negotiator.
Absolutely. And your ability to listen.
Whew, I've got that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
Understanding that the psychological aspects at that deal are really, really important to know, because one of the key things is how well you negotiate. A lot of course, will depend upon your own risk adverse profile.
Your own appetite for it. So, yeah.
Yeah. If you are risk adverse,
you
might actually take the lower fee real quick because you don't want to challenge what's going on. If you're not, then you'll actually negotiate towards your fee that you want.
That's it. If I'm Donald Trump, I take to Twitter.
Well, he's an interesting gentleman. I won't comment much about him.
Yeah.
But I'm not so sure about his negotiation ability.
I would say he's not too risk averse, though.
No. He doesn't really care.
How do you then negotiate with someone like that?
And there are ways which I cannot name in this podcast.
Just when it was getting exciting.
Hot water. Unfortunately, that is an important aspect. And one of the key things, if we're talking about negotiation, and this is something that has been drummed into Harvard School, especially on negotiation, it's kind of a mantra they have, which is be soft on the person, hard on the problem.
Mm, that's a good way of putting it, actually.
Isn't it?
So this is sort of almost going full circle to where we started, which is, let's say the person opposite us has all the same human fears, negative thoughts, beliefs, all the rest of it that we do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we come back with some sort of
what's wrong with you?
Tell him he's dreaming, what's wrong with him?
Yeah.
That's all he's going to remember.
Yeah.
That was a bit of a light bulb moment.
Isn't it? It has an impact on changing your whole communication strategy. It has an impact on changing the way you behave towards people in general. Not only people that you sell to, but the people within the office. Now we're talking about culture, but we're talking about behavior.
Yep.
What about the way you behave towards your partner or your kids? Do you attack first, or you are more curious about
finding out what the real
reason is.
Yeah. So let's say that again just so that everyone gets that. So you need to be soft on the person but hard on the problem. I like it.
If you negotiate with that, it's very hard to upset a person who thinks this way. It's very hard. If I'm the negotiator and I'm always operating from that kind of philosophy, it's a philosophy.
And let's face it, negotiation is all about influence. Like, you know, it's all about your ability to bring the other party at least part of the way to where you want them to be.
But here's the challenge. It's all pretty much guided by your own self-concept of who you are.
Uh-oh. We're going deep again.
Maybe I shouldn't go there. But this is really, really important to understand. Influence and negotiation and information are all aspects of a negotiation. But if you tend to operate whereby you see that person across you and you treat them as a human being, not just as a number, not just as a commission tick, I think this is a way of being.
Well, yeah, it's definitely a shift in thinking. Because sometimes in negotiation, you see it all the time on TV and things like that. You know, you see plenty of CSI shows where they go in being hard.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and that's what we see is I've got to go and be tough. I've got to go and win the battle. I've got to go and get the best price.
And it's not always possible to think of it as a win-win. But I also think about at Harvard, we talk a lot about value creation. How do you create value in the deal for both you and me so we both win? If we're attacking someone, it's very hard to create value.
It's win-lose or lose-win.
Yeah, they're going to have those negative thought patterns.
Yeah.
And then what happens if we win? Are we going to be able to celebrate our success or not?
Yeah, well, think about this. How do you feel when you compromise on your fee and you still got to deliver the same amount of service? I know most people, if they're honest, will go, they're not 100% vested in having a great outcome. How do you feel when, you know, you come out with a good fee, the client is happy as well? How much more motivated are you to get an amazing result for your client?
So how do you avoid that? Is there a practical strategy that you've got there that, let's say we're sitting in the kitchen, I'm pouring the tea, and I say, Pancho, I really want to sell your home. This is my fee. And you say to me, that's too expensive. So then what should my response to that be? So that we don't end up with a situation where I drop my fee and then just feel like I don't want to serve you.
So the client wants to sell his house for a
premium.
A premium.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't feel that it's worth that premium?
Well, I feel it's worth the premium, but the client doesn't feel like I'm worth the premium.
Yeah. I'm going to take a step back. A lot of what we call framing the number, but also the reference point is really, really important. Let me give you a scenario. Say you've got three agents who are competing for a property listing and you know your competition. And the client says to you, well, I've got three agents. You know, you're the first, second or third, whatever. They've all said that they can do it for 1.5. If you want to be at the table, you're going to lower it. What do you do there?
Me personally, I would say, what makes you say that? Again, we're kind of going back to that questioning thing. You've just trained me well over the last hour or so.
Yeah, it's interesting how it works, isn't it?
So that's the first thing I would say is, you know, what brings you to that conclusion?
So here's two aspects to think about. There's a big difference between understanding when you are being influenced and the difference between influence and the difference between what I call influence and information. That first aspect is pure influence by the client. If the client says to you, I think you need to justify why your fee is high. We've had comparable agents in. They're telling us this. They're providing information. Versus, can you just do it for a lower price because we've got three other agents? So in a negotiation, Harvard speak, there's a big aspect of what we call reference points. And unfortunately, it can be utilized for evil or it can be utilized for good. Let me give you an example of what a reference point is. One agent comes in and a client says to that agent, can you give me a valuation for this property? And the agent thinks the property is worth $1 million. Realistically, but another agent has said that it's worth 1.5. Well, the reference point for the whole negotiation is around that 1.5 because this is human behavior. We always want more. So this becomes a bit of an ethical dilemma. You know that the property screaming on a sunny day is worth one, but the reference point from other agent has gone at 1.5. It comes down to knowing your walk away price. And are you able to negotiate up? And this is where the understanding of numbers is really important. I'm going to jump all over the place. So it gives you time to think about numbers and how they can be reframed.
Yeah.
Okay. So we have a dominant agent, and the agent is dominating a particular area. And so you're an agent that has very little muscle in that area. Let's call it that way. How do you compete against an agent who's very, very dominant? Start to look at the numbers. Numbers hide a lot of information. Don't believe every number you have. A dominant agent, does he sell houses quickly? Does he sell them for full price? Does he embark on marketing campaigns? Does he do this? Does he do this? What do the numbers actually provide? Because once you understand numbers and you can have a meaningful conversation with a client, you're actually able to reframe the whole negotiation and then create value.
So it'd be like, you want me to drop my fee to 1.5%?
Yeah.
How are you coming to that conclusion? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, like what's causing you to think that way?
Yeah.
And then hopefully you can extract something out of them that, you know, so Agent X was in here.
Mm-hmm.
And then you could probably follow through with, okay, so what do you understand about the way we work?
Yeah.
And then work, work it, lead with the numbers so that,
There's in negotiation, there's a very common term called BATNA. And BATNA means best alternative to a negotiated agreement. So you've actually got to know your BATNA from a monetary point of view and from a psychological point of view. This is where your risk adverse profile starts to kick in. It says, will I cave in or will I sell value because I'm actually worth it? So these are the things that are going inside your head. Because if you are totally adamant that you actually add more value and that you're actually worth, say, 2%, you're going to communicate that value based upon your risk adverse profile. A lot of subtleties around this area.
Yes. You've really got to know your customer. You've really got to be looking at, number one, what we've talked about is, number one, you've got to know yourself.
Yes.
Number two, then you've got to know the person sitting opposite you, what sort of profile they might have in terms of what they're looking for and what they feel is safe. Because people generally will go harder towards the direction of fear of loss.
Yes.
Rather than fear of gain.
Yeah.
So that's another.
You've read some of my articles. Good.
I have. Of course I've read some of your articles. I love our chat.
Here's the thing. They did an interesting study at Harvard whereby agents were readily influenced as well. There were four agents chosen. They were given an appraisal on a property. The property was valued at different value points. And that value point is what they came around to. So even the agents were influenced. Same property, same sales in that area, same valuations, but that house would value differently. And what the agent thought the house was valued differently, where they came up to that mark. So numbers play a big part on what we feel is the valuation. So the aspect of negotiation is understanding the difference between information and influence.
That's the crux of it.
Yeah.
Interesting. And you're going to be writing a whole article on this, right?
Yeah.
So that when this podcast goes out and everyone goes, oh, wow, I'd like to read more about that, that's your next piece.
Yeah. It's quite interesting just to understand how you can put certain aspects of a negotiation into certain parts and you can play with those parts because creating value takes a bit of thought process.
Because what everyone values is different.
Yes.
You know, what I value might be different to
and therefore, we have to be very, very good at and skilled at questioning. I've always been fascinated by high-stakes negotiations, especially political ones. I make a point of actually studying them. And you watch the negotiators. And there was one particular Australian negotiator. I think his surname was Butler. He was in the Iranian-Iraqi nuclear agreement trying to get access for their UN operators. And very, very single-minded, calm type of negotiator. And it was actually just interesting to know what the good ones do.
It'd be very interesting at that level because even though you're negotiating on behalf of a country, let's say, and not just on behalf of a vendor, they're still humans.
The stakes are higher.
The stakes are higher, but, you know, but you're still dealing with the human element on both sides.
Yeah. And in terms of understanding yourself, what are your trigger points? Because often people can trigger your viewpoints. I've met many agents when a vendor comes at them and goes, no, you're too expensive.
Yeah.
You're the third agent we've got coming in. You got 10 minutes.
And then it's a battle. Yeah.
So you think.
but it doesn't have to be.
No, it's a choice. Once again, yeah, it's actually understanding yourself. And we talk about what's your walk away price? And as things become difficult, you have to make decisions. You have to make decisions. Can you handle the pressure? Because I can guarantee you, even in uncertain times, you'll often find the top agents do still very well.
Well, that's where, you know, like I can remember interviewing Glenn McGrath, the cricketer, many years ago, you know, because obviously cricket season's coming up and sometimes you'll be in a situation where one team's got one run to win and mm-hmm. you've got a bowler at the other end and mm-hmm. they've got one wicket left and mm-hmm. then the pressure's on both sides. Mm-hmm. You know, and I remember Glenn said to me, it's all about the muscle memory. It's all about the practice, and that's where your training comes from. And yep. so I said to someone, you know, I think the future of real estate is being an Olympic level communicator. Like, and you're going to have to practice communicating
yes.
to an actual Olympic athlete level
yeah.
so that, you know, when these situations come up.
Yeah, you have a different response.
Yeah.
You know, the key thing is, you know, when a client says to you, and this is, people have to take it with a bit of a pinch of salt, I'm only going to pay 1.5. What do? Well, one of the key things we learnt, and it works really well, is to ignore that request. Doesn't mean you don't pay attention to it, but you ignore it totally at the first aspect. And too many salespeople believe it.
Or believe that they have to, that's a low ball tactic.
Yeah, you need to focus on creating as much value in your range of commission that you want. And one of the key things is you need to be able to have the freedom and the process and the skill and the belief to counter that fee aggressively. That's a really important thing to do. Not aggressive in nature, but aggressive in the way you pan it out.
In the way that you present value.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's a great place to leave it, actually. As always, I love our chats. Uh-huh. They're always very very lively and informative. And we all love your articles.
So if they go to the website and type in frontierp.com.au / I've spent a lot of time developing an ebook on the 7 mistakes salespeople make. It's actually 7 psychological mistakes and what you can actually do to correct that when you're in a deal.
Oh, that sounds interesting. So we'll leave that link in the show notes for everyone. Awesome. Pancho, thank you so much.
To connect with all things Elite Agent, including the latest news, coaching and features, subscribe at our website, eliteagent.com.